Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Writers James and Deborah Fallows spent 5 years crisscrossing this country in their single-engine plane. They logged 100,000 miles and scores of conversations with American mayors, factory workers, teachers, regular folks. What they found was a lot less red state, blue state, and a lot more can-do spirit and optimism. This hour on Point, a high-flying adventure into the heart of America. You can join us on air or online. Does this sound like your town or your city? Are you seeing new businesses, new jobs, new hope? Do you only wish things looked so good? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Seattle are James and Deborah Fallows. He's been a national correspondent for The Atlantic for the last 35 years. She's a linguist and a writer, and they're out with a new book. It's called Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. And you can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. James and Deborah, welcome to the program. How nice to have you.
Jane,
thanks,
thank you.
Jane.
So I just love the premise of your book, traveling to quote-unquote flyover countries, it's sometimes referred to the country between the coasts, the heart of America. Tell us how this all started back in 2013, right, when you posted a request online. What was the request and what was the response?
So the request I put on my part of The Atlantic's website back 5 years ago was to say, tell us the story of your town and why it's a representative of American story now. We said that we were looking for places that were smaller cities, you know, not little tiny hamlets necessary, but ones that weren't normally in the media coverage, where you didn't have the same, sort of picture in your mind's eye that you do, that everyone has of San Francisco or New York or D.C. We also were looking for towns that had some kind of challenge. Economic, factory closing, environmental, any other difficulty that had challenged the town, and where there was some kind of interesting response. And over the next week or two, we got about 1,000 essays of people saying, here's why Moline, Illinois, here's why Walla Walla, Washington, here's why you name it, town in almost every state is the American saga. And so we started going place by place in a partly planned out, partly opportunistic fashion. We ended up in every corner of the country, about 25 cities where we spent a long time, that is to say a couple of weeks. And that was what led us to this report.
And Deborah, you didn't just get names of towns, right? You received these long, heartfelt narrations of the stories of these places and of people's lives, really.
That's right. We did. It was really impressive to us that we felt we were onto something when so many people wrote in and wanted to tell us their stories, not just naming their towns. And then we would make some phone calls or email people back, go online, look at the local newspaper online, look at the towns, .com website to get a sense of what might be there and throw some darts at the map and set off.
So, James, as you said, you were looking for places that had suffered some kind of challenge, an economic downturn or big demographic shifts or whatever it may have been. Did you start with a thesis statement in the back of your mind, or were you more a blank slate?
So, you know, nobody, of course, is a blank slate about everything. And having lived as many decades of life and reporting life as both of us had, we had certain assumptions or questions about the world. But the main precondition was in the previous years when we've been living in China, we had both been hearing about all the horrible effects through the U.S. economy of the economic collapse of 2008, 2009. And we'd heard the increasing narrative from China and the rest of the world that maybe the United States experiment had finally run out of gas, and this was sort of a historical turning point for the U.S. We learned in China and other places that just is different to be on scene in places away from the Capitol. So we wanted to go to places in the U.S., not ask them, how are you feeling about Obama? How are you feeling about this or that other polarizing national issue? But rather, what is the saga here in Sioux Falls? What is making Sioux Falls, South Dakota get better now? What is holding it back? What do people hope for the future? And that was an accumulation of those experiences over the months made us think there was more of a there to locally level, local level recovery and ambition than we would have expected.
Mm. Deborah, you write about a country really remaking itself, a civic and economic reinvention taking place, taking hold across America, town by town, and generally out of view of the national news media, certainly, but other ways too. What was most surprising to you about your journey into the heart of America?
There were so many surprising things. I think one of the most surprising was the degree of collaboration and general getting alongness that you find town by town. Like the country, towns are made up of conservative and liberal people, sometimes within a single administration of the town. But we really found that when you're close to your neighbors, when you're in a place where you feel like you can have a personal impact on things, when you're accountable every day for what you do and visible to the people you see every day, that it's both you feel more responsible and it feels easier to have some control over what you do with respect to how you're trying to make your town go.
I wrote some common threads that I found from your writing in the towns that you visited across the country. Give us a sense of what you think some of those common threads are. The first I wrote down was that local government is actually working in many of these places.
Yes, that is the case. And let me just anticipate one question that might be in some of your listeners' minds right now, which is, were we going only to really nice places? Or are we saying that the United States is without problem at the local level, which is not at all what we're saying. We went to some really difficultly challenged place. We're in San Bernardino, California, which is right near where I'm from, which is a really troubled part of California. We were in Rust Belt cities like Erie, Pennsylvania, and Allentown. We, as we'll talk later, we spent a lot of time in Mississippi. So I think we were in places they were well aware of the challenges they had, but they felt as if the movement was in a positive rather than the negative direction. And one aspect of that was just the point you made that at this level in national politics, I think regardless which side you are on electorally at the national level, you can't feel really good about the functioning of the national government. But in ways that are illustrated by opinion polls, polls show that something like 75 or 80% of the public feels as if its local community and its local government is moving in the right direction in addressing educational problems and job problems and all the rest. And we felt that the people believe they could make longer-term plans. I can give you some illustrations in a moment, but I agree with that premise.
I want to get Dana in here from Wellfleet, Massachusetts, has a question and a comment for you both, Deborah and James Fallows. Dana, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. This, to me, just sounds like another pretentious American fairy tale to reflect the agenda of the powerful and the privileged. I mean, people like me can't even go to Boston for a day. And there are many like me. I'm one of the luckier ones. There are many like me who are struggling to make ends meet. And I think it's really kind of offensive to hear the rhetoric of can-do spirit and optimism when there's some serious problems in this country. And you two are flying around the world in some multi-thousand dollar jet.
Well, it's actually not that. But, Dana, I hear your point, and Deborah and James speak to that, because I think there are a lot of people out there that may be having the same feeling.
Of course. And that was what I was trying to anticipate before and what I was saying in the earlier question. So we started this process. And let me point out that while for a long time we've had this little single-engine plane, which is obviously a huge privilege to have, but it's like a little flying car.
It's a prop plane.
It's a little prop plane, single-engine plane. We only flew in the daytimes. And we spent – that was how we got from place to place. But 99% of the time on this journey, we were in these towns talking with people. And the places we went have genuine challenges. Fresno, California, in Central Valley, California, if the Central Valley of California became a state, as some people have proposed, it would be the poorest state in the country. It would be poorer than Mississippi, it'd be poorer than Arkansas, etc. And so the challenges of a modern American life, of polarization, of environmental challenge, of ethnic ambition and strife, you find in Central Valley, California, as vividly as you find any place in the United States. In Erie, Pennsylvania, you have this a sort of classic case of Rust Belt tension, where General Electric, which had this huge locomotive plant, has been dismantling it over the decade, last decade plus, moving the jobs to Texas, as it happens, not overseas, but to Texas. And so you can see in the warehouse structure of Erie what that means. In West Virginia, where we were, opioids are, you know, the problem every place, but they're a special problem there. In Duluth, Minnesota, you see the remains of what had been a great grain shipping empire. So in places like that, where people are having all of the economic challenges of this era, we asked them in the schools, in the libraries, in the factories, did they feel they were moving forward or did they feel they were moving backwards? And generally, most places felt better about the moving forward in the area they knew about directly than in what they heard about in the rest of the country. That may not be the case in Wellfleet, but it was the case in most of Mississippi and in most of upstate Ohio and in the Dakotas and the Central Valley, California. And so most places we saw felt as if they, at least the direction was positive.
And if I could add just one thing from a personal point of view, Jim and I grew up in small towns ourselves. And in particular, I grew up right in the middle of the Rust Belt in northern Ohio between the Ford plant and the GM plant and next to the steel mills, all of which have either closed or downsized extremely largely. So both of us come to this with a lot of empathy and understanding. We were going in not out of our own personal experience of having lost jobs, but with the personal background of having grown up in places where that has happened to a majority of the people.
We are speaking with James and Deborah Fallows this hour about their five-year journey into the heart of this country and the stories they gathered, and why they came away from that project more hopeful about this country's future. We'll talk more about that after the break. You can join us. Tell us what's going on in your neck of the woods, good and bad. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Scott Detrow. There is so much political news to follow these days, but you don't have to keep up with all of it. You just have to keep up with us on the NPR Politics podcast. You can find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're speaking this hour with James and Deborah Fallows about their new book, Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. And you can join the conversation, Do You See the America They Saw, when you turn on cable news. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Here is James communicating with the airport controller in that little single-engine prop plane as he and Deb are traveling around the country, this time coming into land.
435, Sarah is about 3 miles out on the right base. We're actually coming up to the Jacobu intersection.
Sierra Romeo, Bill's around there, on site, runway 36, clear to land.
Clear to land, 36, 435, Sarah.
Got that sound off the Atlantic's website. Do you happen to remember where you were when you were coming into land there, Jim?
I'm pretty sure that was in Mississippi. I think we're coming into the Golden Triangle Airport in Mississippi, which is a new one around which they've had a number of economic developments. Mm.
Give us an example. Just throw something out there that really hit you from your travels, something that was maybe unexpected.
So, Deb, you want to go? Or just, I'm trying to think of how to choose. I guess something that happened very early on, one of the first cities we went to and spent substantial time in was in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, which is a place I had not actually ever been to before, and I don't think many people have an idea of in the news. And the two things that were striking there, I'll tell you three things are striking. One is what a center of advanced technology agricultural industry it has become. We went out to a place called Raven Industries, which is making these GPS guidance systems for these enormous tractors to be radically more sustainable in the kind of farming they do, where the plant, they'll have a very precise GPS location for where a seed goes in and then later a drop of fertilizer to that exact same place, and then the proper amount of water to that exact same place. And that was something we ended up seeing lots of different places. So advanced tech in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. We ended up seeing the major heavy industry in the town is this giant slaughterhouse in the center of town, 100 plus years old, which is now owned by a Chinese firm because they like higher quality American meat. Many of the workers there are female refugees from Islamic countries, Somalia, Sudan, elsewhere, who are working in a slaughterhouse killing pigs so as to send their children to Sioux Falls High School and sort of live out the American possibilities and the ways in which a mainly white, mainly Northern Plains town has become a center of absorbing refugees and views them as part of its essence. And I guess also the sense in Sioux Falls of people feeling they'd come from other parts of the plains, this was just the right size of town. It was big enough to have the ambitions and opportunities of a large town, small enough to be still convenient to get around with. So there was this whole sort of ecosystem in Sioux Falls that I hadn't expected.
And one of the things that surprised me was actually an example from town to town to town was the role of the public libraries in the town. When I first went into a public library to see what was going on, I kind of thought to myself, well, why am I going in here? I know what's going on in public libraries. People go read and borrow books. And what I found after that, from Burlington, Vermont, to Greenville, South Carolina, to Columbus, Georgia, to the West Coast and Bend, Oregon, and Dodge City, Kansas, is that libraries are becoming a new focal point in the center of town, in all these little towns, to fill in the gaps for things that towns are having trouble addressing themselves, as, for example, in education. So much preschool education, and on the other end, teaching literacy to adults. In the realm of technology, there are computers for everybody and a lot of teaching going on with them. And in a social and civic sense, you get ESL classes, citizenship classes, and recreation like doing the tango or teaching yoga.
Let me get Percy in here, who's got a comment from Sacramento, California. Hi, Percy. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Yes, I just want to tell them, the couple there, that just more power to them. I think it's a fantastic thing they've done, and see the different ways and different things that different people are doing throughout the country, and, you know, not just sitting on their rear end, but actually, you know, making things happen.
Percy, thank you very much. Let me get Bob in here from Gastonia, North Carolina. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
I'm fine.
I really enjoy your conversation. I had a similar experience. A few years ago, I went from Kansas City, Missouri to Virginia City, Nevada in a Pony Express ride where we went 50 miles a day and we stopped in these towns across the country. And it was the same thing that your guests have experienced, that people want to get along. They look for the positive in things, whether they're liberal, whether they're conservative. They want to find a positive direction for their communities, and I found that the world is not as jugular as you might see in the news, whether it's from the left news or the right news. And I think that's probably something that we don't experience enough or recognize enough, because if we look in our country today, the fastest growing political party is not affiliated. And I think that sends a loud message that the majority of people in America don't look at America as either black or white. We look at it as gray, where there's a place for everybody, and that we do look for the commonality in everyone. And that,
Bob, thanks so much. Deborah and James, you describe in your book what you call the cable news effect, and Bob makes reference to it somewhat. Tell us about that and how that was sort of ingrained in America.
So I think Bob's point is a really, really rings true to us, that we often will hear, especially on cable news, that America is historically divided and polarized and can't agree on anything. And that is true if you're talking about the U.S. Congress right now, or if you're talking about the political conventions of the National Party. But it just is not the way it seems operationally, city by city. I have a whole chapter in the book comparing Burlington, Vermont, very progressive, with Greenville, South Carolina, very conservative, and saying that if you didn't know their national party affiliations, you might think they were the same town because they work the same way. The cable news effect, I think, makes it harder for national media to perceive these things, because if somebody is doing a story for a national media outlet and they go to a place in Iowa or Nebraska and say, okay, tell us, what do you think about the Russians? What do you think about Trump? Do you still like Trump? What do you think about Hillary? You're going to get answers that come straight from the realm of cable news, where everything is two-dimensional. You have your pros and your cons, whereas the three-dimensionality of life that we all have in our existences and that places across the country have, the dramas, the compromise, the sense of the balance of good and bad, those things which are so vivid in the communities we saw, they get flattened out, and thereby you come back, people will come back saying, well, I've talked to them in Iowa and they're still either pro-Trump or they're anti-Trump. These divisions go on, which seems to be misreading. It's reading 1% of American life, an important 1%, but it's leaving out a lot of the rest.
Tell us another story, James Fallows. You mentioned Greenville, South Carolina. It's certainly an interesting example of a place that lost its textile manufacturing and now really is reinventing itself. Tell us what you saw there.
The drama of Greenville. So Greenville has been through a number of economic generations over the time. Back before the Civil War, it was already a manufacturing center because it's along the fall line of the Appalachians where water comes down to propel these water wheels. And during the 70s and 80s, Greenville was a still thriving textile town. But about that time, Greenville has had an exceptionally sort of visionary series of city governors, and they have statues of them, city mayors. They've had statues of them, and they said, this is not going to last. We know these textile mills are going to go away, whether it's through NAFTA or WTA or something, but this is going to change. Starting in the 80s and early 90s, cooperative efforts of Republicans and Democrats in the state government, in the city government, in the regional planning organizations, and the universities started going around the world saying, here is why Greenville, which you probably have never heard of, is a ideal location for companies from France and from Germany and from Japan, from other places. And over these last couple of decades, they attracted a BMW plant, which exports most of its manufacturing from South Carolina to the rest of the world, a big Michelin plant, a GE plant making advanced wind turbines and other sorts of things. And Greenville has become a very upscale place. I mean, it's a downtown where you hear French and German spoken on the street. Even though it's the home of Trey Gowdy as its political representative, and before him Jim DeMint, home of Bob Jones University, but is as vivid a urban success story as you could find. And in contrast to Deb,
There's a very interesting way now that the industry that has moved to and is established in Greenville engage with the public school community there. The industry says, we want to train these kids who are growing up in Greenville to have the opportunity to work in skilled jobs in these companies that we have here. So they have very heavily invested both as volunteers and materially in the public school system. There's a school, the A.J. Wittenberg Elementary School of Engineering, which is pre-K through 4, where they start the kids on having the STEM classes infused into their little bitty liberal arts classes for up to fourth graders. And that people from the companies come and volunteer and teach them how to do baby engineering kinds of things. In the middle school, they've inserted an A into STEM and call it the STEAM schools because the company said, not only do we're doing pretty well with the STEM stuff, but let's make sure that these kids have rich and full lives and can communicate well, write well, cooperate with each other, debate. So they have a whole arts infusion into the public school system as well.
You know, it's innovation in schools and businesses in many of the places where you've been. But aesthetically, things have changed in Greenville, South Carolina as well. Here's the mayor of Greenville, Knox White, describing to CBS's Sunday Morning how his town brought the center of the city back to life by simply exposing a waterfall most residents didn't even know was there.
The beautiful waterfall was covered over by a four-lane highway bridge for 40 years.
So no one ever saw it.
Most people who lived in Greenville all their lives had never seen the waterfall. It was a very hard sell that we're going to spend money to build a beautiful park around a waterfall you've never seen. Trust us. Until they did.
It's city planning, too, as much as anything else, James.
It is. And I think there's it highlights another contrast between this state or and city level things and national politics, which is if somebody on the national level announces an ambition for a project whose benefits will be realized in 20 years, I think everybody rolls his or her eyes unless we're talking military projects because we know they have long-term funding. But going to the moon, having some new infrastructure ambition, we've sort of given up hope those things can be done at the national level, even though we know how important they have been historically, from the interstate highways to all the structures for the from the WPA in the 1930s that we saw still around the country. But many cities we saw were able to announce and build support for and carry out these very long-term ambitions because people had the sense that it could actually happen. There was a similar project to this wonderful Falls Park in Greenville, South Carolina, in Sioux Falls, where they made their own falls part of a centerpiece of downtown. And I'm thinking of just there are trails and conservation areas that we have seen all over the place. Fresno is now in the middle of a very ambitious downtown reconstruction. I'll give you one other example. In Holland, Michigan, a little manufacturing town where we went, politically very conservative. It's where Betsy DeVos is from. But it's an extremely snowy area. They get about 10 feet of snow per year. And a couple of decades ago, one of the wealthy industrialists said, "Our problem is our snow." And he came up with a plan to pipe the waste heat water from the city industrial, you know, coal-burning power plant, pipe that through plastic pipes underneath all the sidewalks and cities of the town, saying we're going to have no roads for a year, but after that, we're going to have no snow. And it actually worked. And so he put up half the money, the city put up half the money, and now they have a snow-free little island in the middle of Michigan.
It's a great story. Let me get to Little Eagle, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Hello, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, I'm from South Dakota, Standing Rock Reservation. I've been a trucker for 30 years now, been 3 million miles across this country. I've seen this country from a thriving, bustling, great manufacturing economy just disappear into ghost town after ghost town. I don't want to make too much of that. But I think it's nice to be hopeful. Well, remember, we had 8 years of somebody who wrote a book called The Audacity of Hope. And he tried everything in his power to talk about all these things this nice, wonderful couple is talking about and failed. And I think the one thing that people don't realize in this country is the deep, very, very, the virus of racism, of fractured relationships as far as the two-party system goes. And we have got so bogged down right now in this Republican and Democrat thing.
You see a lot of deep divide. I'm going to interrupt for time's sake, Little Eel, but thank you so much for calling. I mean, there's someone who is less optimistic than both of you. I mean, he's a trucker. He drives by these, manufacturing towns that have disappeared. What do you say to him?
So yes, I say that I agree on most of his premises. Obviously, race and the legacy of slavery and the legacy of treatment of Native Americans, those are the fundamental axes of American sin that we have dealt with ever since. It is true that through American history, some smaller settlements have always been closing. I think in every census since the Civil War, most counties in the United States have lost population. So there's been this constant churning of people from really small settlements. It's also true that in every decade of American history, the economic structure has changed. Less than 150 years ago, most Americans were farmers. You know, most people made their living in farming. Now it's about 1% of the population that does that. So there's been continuing churn. What we are reporting is the next stage that we've been able to see of most places feeling as if in the part of America they're familiar with directly, they feel as if the progress is there is more progress than regress.
I'd also like to say that Jim and I actually feel a great kinship with the truckers. As we flew across the country, it was very easy to look down to the string of highways like I-80 across the central part of the Midwest, because we were so low over these roads that you could see the strings, and Sirius XM radio played the road trucker station that we listened to day in and day out.
That's great. It offers a unique perspective, certainly, how you saw this country. We are speaking with Deborah and James Fallows. Their new book is called Our Towns. It's a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. Listeners, if I asked you to define the American character, what would you say? Does this country make it through thick and thin because of people like you and your neighbors? I'm Jane Clayson. Much more after this break, including your calls. Stick with us. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
It's not a secret. Parenting is hard. But maybe we shouldn't put so much pressure on ourselves.
To get to good outcomes, sometimes you do better by not worrying about outcomes at all.
I'm Shankar Vedantam, host of Hidden Brain. Join us as we explore two very different models of what it means to raise a human.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about what is working in America today, about what people in our towns and cities are doing to revitalize and make a go of things, creating new jobs, better schools. You can join the conversation. Tell us what you see that gives you hope in your town. Is there no hope? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests this hour, James and Deborah Fallows, authors of Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. And a reminder, you can find an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. I want to introduce another voice now into the conversation, someone that you both met on your travels. Brenda Latham joins me from Columbus, Mississippi. She's Senior Vice President for Economic Development at the Golden Triangle Development Link, a public-private partnership in northeastern Mississippi. Brenda, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
And thanks, Jane. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you. Tell me where you grew up, Brenda.
I grew up in Oklahoma, Mississippi.
All right. And when did you start to see your area, your region, your town kind of start to go into decline?
Well, we started to experience a decline in the late 1990s and early 2000s when local factories started to close because the majority of the factories were textile, woodworks, things like that. And those jobs went overseas, and there was nothing left for the employees to do.
And you saw people leave, you saw people disperse, and really, really struggle, right? What turned things around? Was there a moment that you remember?
Well, the moment that stands out the most is when American Eurocopter decided to build helicopters here in the Golden Triangle. And that was a skill set that we weren't familiar with. However, our community college had recently built the Center for Manufacturing Technology Excellence, and they were able to retrain employees and work with manufacturers and preparing employees for the work that was about to happen. Mm.
You mentioned the community college. It's a real source of pride and a real need in this community. Here's Raj Shanak. He's the Vice President for Workforce and Community Services at East Mississippi Community College. That's in Columbus, Mississippi. He trains and retrains people in his community so they can work at this Airbus helicopter factory, which is the Yokohama tire plant, and other places. Here he is speaking with the Fallows during their visit there.
It's a quaint little college. We have roughly 3,500 students here. When I started working here 20 years ago, we had 350 students. The economy was dying. Now the transformance has occurred, and we have high-skilled, high-wage jobs. So people from making pork chops and making hot dogs are making helicopters and unmanned aircraft, and we are the shining example of Make It in America.
A shining example there in Columbus, Mississippi. Brenda, tell us how salaries changed in your community and what happened after people are now being trained.
Well, the salaries, of course, increased tremendously, beginning with Airbus. People there make around $50,000 a year. And in 2005, Steel Dynamics located here. And those employees make between $80,000 and $100,000 a year. And so, and then we have PACCAR, and a good story I think I can tell about PACCAR is when they first opened, they had to keep their parking lots washed down because of the oil coming from the cars, because people couldn't afford state-of-the-art cars. Now they don't have that problem anymore.
Mm. A real example of the shift. What do you hear, Brenda, in the Fallows' journey, in their story, specific to where you grew up, what you've seen in your own community?
Well, of course, where I grew up was a farming community, and then it became a textile community. But here in Columbus, what we see happening is more advanced manufacturing, and as Dr. Shanak mentioned, the Center for Manufacturing Technology Excellence has taken that to another level. There's not a job that can be brought to this area that people can't be trained to do, and our people are very trainable.
Hmm. Well, Brenda Lathan, we really appreciate your time today from Columbus, Mississippi, helping us understand what's happening in your corner of the world. Thank you very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brenda.
Thanks, Brenda.
You know, it's an interesting something she mentioned, the public-private partnerships are really another common thread that you saw in a lot of these towns across this country. Explain what that means and why it's a key solution that you identified.
So in my previous life as a reporter, I had what I think is the standard D.C. reporter's sort of eye-rolling skepticism about the phrase public-private partnership. What could this mean? It just seemed like some sort of slogan for getting money to corporations. In fact, now I think that's been – it's the bedrock of so many of the successful efforts that we saw around the country. Brenda was too modest to mention the role that she and her colleague Joe Max Higgins have played in sort of forging these partnerships in Mississippi among the state government, the county governments, some federal TVA projects, and specific big international companies working with school systems to bring factories there to train the local workforce for them, and everybody sort of doing things together. But one of the tests we ended up having for successful cities is if you said the term public-private partnership, was there something tangible they could say, oh, yeah, this came from that? Was it like in Greenville, South Carolina, the school Deb mentioned, where GE and Michelin engineers train these little elementary school kids in engineering? Was it something in Bend, Oregon, where the county government was working with high-tech companies to train people for new jobs? So I have changed from being a typical Washington skeptic about this phrase to being a believer that this is part of the necessary machinery of moving America forward.
Mm. Let me get Richard in here, a listener in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hi, Richard. I'm glad you waited. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on what James was talking about when he said he saw like the slaughterhouse we have here in town. And Ravens, and also I'd like to mention that we do have a fairly large, you know, hospital base. I think because I work at one of the hospitals.
So you've seen the reinvention, the rejuvenation there in Sioux Falls. You've witnessed it for yourself, Richard.
Yeah, because There's the Denny Sanford, the philanthropist. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does a lot of good deeds here in Sioux Falls, and I think he, from being out, I don't know why he has a connection with Sioux Falls, but he does a lot of good things for our town. And we just recently had our arena. We just had a big arena added on, or like a stadium thing. Mm. And it's all because of him, and everybody in Sioux Falls wanted to get together and stuff. And we have, I think we have a fairly decent community here. You know, we do have our strives and stuff, but there's a lot of good here. And I don't think a lot of people realize that, you know, smaller towns can have, you know, big opportunities like that. So,
Richard, thank you. I really appreciate it. Yeah.
One of the things that we saw in Sioux Falls that was very interesting as well is how the town is working to enrich the texture of its populace in town. You think of Sioux Falls being a place, which it is, of largely Nordic and Germanic heritage. 10% of the school system in Sioux Falls is refugees. They've had a long history since the Vietnam War of taking in wave after wave of refugees. And the way that the town and the school and the people work to make those different segments, incoming segments of the population, fit in, adjust, contribute to the energy and the just general sensibility of what life is like in Sioux Falls, that it's not just all Nordic, it's also Sudan and Darfur and Somalia, is a really inspiring case. Mm.
And they do have a big medical establishment there, as Richard said, and a big university establishment, and it's a diverse, progressive economy.
Thanks so much for the call. You also went to, well, you went to many places, but Duluth was another interesting example. Here's a clip from a couple there. Laura Mullen and Brian Taunus are two of four founders of the Bent Paddle Brewery in Duluth, Minnesota. The four of them have grown up there or gone to college nearby, and then they moved away, but they wanted to raise their families in a nice place, so they came back to Duluth. Here they are speaking to CBS's Sunday Morning.
There was a billboard 10, 20 years ago that said, last one leaving Duluth, turn out the light. There was this mentality that there were no jobs. And I definitely felt that too. I said, I have to create my own job if I'm coming back up here.
There's definitely a bit of a wave of people moving back that have lived here in the past and, you know, looking at new opportunities and kind of thinking outside of the box to try to figure out how to make a good living here.
A lot of young people you highlight, Deborah and James, sort of carving out a new life in towns that many people had written off, looking at the old with new eyes, if you will.
Yes. And so it will certainly – it'll continue to be the case that people move to New York for finance. They move to San Francisco for technology and D.C. for government, et cetera, et cetera. But it was striking to us how much of a reverse wave you saw, too, of ambitious people who could have started their companies any place in any big city. But they thought that I like the feel of Duluth or of Bend or of Sioux Falls or of Burlington. I think I can be engaged there in a different way than I could if I were in New York or in D.C. And the burn rate of real estate costs is so dramatically different that I have all sorts of other possibilities. So we saw this kind of repopulation of ambitious young people thinking the next stage for them, Sam, was not some kind of suburban ideal of just being out on the fringe of a big city, but being part of a community on the rise.
Let's get Rachel in here from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, go ahead.
My comment is the growth and increase in popularity of our neighborhood public schools. We've been working with our neighborhood public schools in a neighborhood of East Hills at Congress, and just over the years, the past couple of years, we've seen an increase of people that live in our neighborhood choosing that as a top schools instead of moving out to the suburbs for other schools. And the other great thing, too, is because people are attracted to that people-first neighborhood, the walkability, the traditional storefronts and local businesses, we've also seen an increase in partnerships between our public schools and our local businesses. Just last week for Teacher Appreciation Week, every day we had a local restaurant donate lunch to our entire staff at our school. And that's just great.
Another example of that public-private partnership that we mentioned. Rachel, thank you so much for the call from Grand Rapids. Let's go to Bob in Bristol, Connecticut. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Jane, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I want to talk about a different sort of reinvention, I think. Bristol, long a manufacturing community, wedded to actually the automotive industry. We had a our largest employer was a plant that made springs for General Motors, and it slowly declined and
died
eventually
out.
Closed.
Yeah.
And then we got ESPN. We are the headquarters for ESPN,
mm-hmm.
the largest sports programming network in the world, I think. And it was a certain amount of serendipity to it, but I have to tell you, Bristol has reinvented itself because it was smart enough to adapt to changing times and changing circumstances. The people, I mean, ESPN is our largest employer.
Mm-hmm.
My son worked as an mm-hmm. electrician at ESPN.
Mm-hmm.
But also the people who come here from other places, the people who brought in, they live here and they contribute to our lives.
Bob, thank you so much for the call. You know, Deborah, to that point, to Bob's point, you say when towns are trying to reinvent themselves, to change, to innovate, to repurpose, they really need to figure out who they are, right? They need to define sort of what they want for the future.
The sense of the local is so strong as you go around from town to town. And one of the things that the woman from Grand Rapids was talking about in schools really resonates with that. You get a town like Winters, California. It's a small agricultural town about 60 miles southeast of San Francisco. In that school now, they know that in order to keep the kids in town, to keep them enthused about the agriculture that they're going to be doing in the future, they need to teach in the schools about how agriculture works. So half the kids in the school take classes about the history and economics of agriculture, how to use and maintain the farm equipment. They have orchards out behind their school that the kids learn how to work. And it's not just working on the farms. It's the modern new kind of technology and biotech that's going to make towns like that adapt to the future. So the taking the local and recognizing the assets and bringing them up to the modern time is something that is very exciting about how towns adapt as well.
We only got about a minute left here. You think about the heart of America and you think about the deep characteristics of Americans, generous, patriotic, working for the common good. We still have a lot of problems in this country. No one is denying that. But to the core of who we are as a people, what did you discover, James and Deborah?
So I think if you just listen, think of the last couple of calls we've had in the show, talking with Brenda and Richard and Rachel and Bob about the experiences in their towns, hearing that a thousandfold over the past 5 years, that has been what has sort of changed our minds of recognizing that people city by city feel as if they are figuring out, in the process of continuing to figure out, how they and their neighbors can build a better community and better opportunities. So we are positive about the potential that is there across the texture of the country.
Deb Fallis, I'll give you the last word. What stuck with you as you traveled place to place?
So what stuck with me is what I heard from place to place, that this is a big country. And while we all think we might speak the same language, when you go to Greenville, South Carolina, and listen to the little lilt of Mayor Knox White, and they say, "Dadgum if we didn't do it," or "Katie, bar the door." And if you're in Mississippi, you'll hang on the elevator button for 20 minutes while people say, "How are you today?" and answer that question with great flourish. So it's a big and diverse place out there that we actually love.
The book is Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. James Fallis, national correspondent for The Atlantic. Deborah's co-author. Deb is a linguist. Well, let's not forget her co-pilot here. thanks so much for your time today and for your experiences. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane.
Thanks, Jane.
Continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Thanks so much for your calls. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.